This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Most of the stories that we read are set sometime between roughly the 1830s and perhaps the early 1900s, but we occasionally read more contemporary stories, substituting pickup trucks for horses and double-wide trailers for cabins or bunkhouses. Today we will begin reading another set of contemporary stories, but these come with a twist. They are all written by Native Americans. Our book is entitled Talking Leaves, Contemporary Native American Short Stories. It is edited by Craig Leslie, and it was published in 1991 by Delta Trade Paperbacks in New York City. And let me remind you that our stories are sometimes edited for recording. The author provides a lengthy introduction, which I am not going to read, but he ends it with a quote from N. Scott Momaday from a book called Sun Tracks, published in Tucson by the University of Arizona Press in 1976. I think the storyteller in Indian tradition understands that he is dealing with something that is timeless. He has a sense of its projection into the past, and it's an unlimited kind of projection. I am speaking, I am telling a story, I am doing something that my fathers, 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 father did. That kind of understanding of the past and of the continuity in the human voice is a real element in the oral tradition, and it goes forward in the same way. I am here, and what I am doing is back here, and it will be here. And again, that was from N. Scott Momaday. Our first story is by Paula Gunn Allen, and it is entitled Dear Woman. Two young men were out snagging one afternoon. They rode around in their pickup, their Indian Cadillac, cruising up this road and down that one, through steamy green countryside, stopping by friends' places here and there to lift a few beers. The day was sultry and searing, as summer days in Oklahoma get, hot as a sweat lodge. Long after dark, they stopped at a tavern 20 or 30 miles outside of Anadarko and joined some skins gathered around several tables. After the muggy heat outside, the slowly turning fan inside felt cool. When they'd been there a while, one of the men at their table asked them if they were headed to the stomp dance. Sure, they said, though truth to tell, they hadn't known there was a stomp dance that night in the area. The three headed out to the pickup. They drove for some distance along narrow country roads, turning occasionally at unmarked crossings, bumping across cattle guards, until at length they saw the light of the bonfire, several unshaded lights hanging from small huts that ringed the dance ground, and headlights from a couple of parked cars. They pulled into a spot in the midst of a new Winnebago, a Dodge van, two Toyotas, and a small herd of more battered models, and made their way to the dance ground. The dance was going strong, and the sound of turtle shell and aluminum can rattles in singing, mixed with occasional laughter and bits of talk, reached their ears. All right, Ray, the taller and heavier of the two, exclaimed, slapping his buddy's raised hand in glee. Gnarly, his pal Jackie responded, and they grinned at each other in the unsteady light. Slapping the man who'd ridden along with them on the back, the taller one said, Man, let's go find us some snags. They hung out all night, occasionally starting a conversation with one good-looking woman or another, but though the new brother who had accompanied them soon disappeared with a long-legged beauty named Lorene, the two anxious friends didn't score. They were not the sort to feel disheartened, though. They kept up their spirits, dancing well and singing even better. They didn't really care so much about snagging, as it gave them something to focus on while they filled the day and night with interesting activity. They were among their own, and they were satisfied with their lives and with themselves. Toward morning, though, Ray spotted two strikingly beautiful young women stepping into the dance ground. Their long hair flowed like black rivers down their backs. They were dressed out in traditional clothes, and something about them, something elusive, made Ray shiver with a feeling almost like recognition, and at the same time, like dread. "Who are they?" he asked his friend, but Jackie shrugged silently. Ray could see his eyes shining for a moment as the fire near them flared suddenly. At the same moment, they both saw the young women looking at them out of the corners of their eyes as they danced modestly and almost gravely past. Jackie nudged Ray and let out a long, slow sigh. "All right," he said in a low, almost reverent voice. "All right." When the dance was ended, the young women made their way to where the two youths were standing. "Hey, dude," one of them said. "My friend and I need a ride to Anadarko, and they told us you were coming from there." As she said that, she gestured with her chin over her left shoulder toward a vaguely visible group standing across the dance ground. "What's your friend's name?" Ray countered. "Linda," the other woman said. "Hers is Junella." "My friend's name is Jackie," Ray said, grinning. "When do you want to take off?"
"Whenever,"
Junella answered. She held his eyes with hers.
"Where are you parked?"
They made their way to the pickup and got in. It was a tight fit, but nobody seemed to mind. Ray drove, backing the pickup carefully to thread among the haphazardly parked vehicles that had surrounded theirs while they were at the dance. As he did, he glanced down for a second and thought he saw the feet of both women as deer hooves. "Man," he thought, "I gotta lay off the weed." He didn't remember he'd quit smoking it months before, and hadn't had a beer since they'd left the tavern hours before. The women tucked their feet under their bags, and in the darkness he didn't see them anymore. Besides, he had more soothing things on his mind. They drove companionably for some time, joking around, telling a bit about themselves, their taste in music, where they'd gone to school, when they'd graduated. Linda kept fiddling with the dial, reaching across Junella to get to the knob. Her taste seemed to run to hardcore country and western, or what Ray privately thought of as space music. She and Linda occasionally lapsed into what seemed like a private conversation or joke. Ray couldn't be sure which. Then, as though remembering themselves, they'd laugh and engage the men in conversation again. After they'd traveled for an hour or so, Linda suddenly pointed to a road that intersected the one they were on. "Take a left," she said, and Ray complied. He didn't even think about it, or protest that they were on the road to Anadarko already. A few hundred yards further, she said, "Take a right." Again, he complied, putting the brake on suddenly as he went into the turn, spilling Junella hard against him. He finished shifting quickly and put his arm around her. She leaned into him, saying nothing, and put her hand on his thigh. The road they had turned onto soon became gravel, and by the time they'd gone less than a quarter of a mile, turned into hard-packed dirt. Ray could smell water nearby. He saw some trees standing low on the horizon and realized it was coming light.
"Let's go to the water," Linda said. "Junella and I are kind of traditional, and we try to wash in fresh running water every morning."
"Yeah," Junella murmured. "We were raised by our mother's grandmother, and the old lady was real strict about some things. She always made sure we prayed to Long Man every day. Hope it's okay." Jackie and Ray climbed out of the truck, the women following. They made their way through the thickest of scrub oak and bushes and clambered down the short bank to the stream, the men leading the way. They stopped at the edge of the water, but the young women stepped right in, though still dressed in their dance clothes. They bent and splashed water on their faces,
speaking the old tongue softly as they did so. The men removed their tennis shoes and followed suit, removing their caps and tucking them in the hip pockets of their jeans. After a suitable silence, Junella pointed to the opposite bank with her uplifted chin. "See that path?" she asked the men. "I think it goes to our old house. Let's go up there and see." "Yeah," Linda said. "I thought it felt familiar around here. I bet it is our old place." When the women didn't move to cross the shallow river and go up the path, the men took the lead again. Ray briefly wondered at his untypical pliability, but banished the thought almost as it arose. He raised his head just as he reached the far bank and saw that the small trees and brush were backed by a stone bluff that rose steeply above them. As he tilted his head back to spot the top of the bluff, he had a flashing picture of the small round feet he thought he'd seen set against the floorboard of the truck. But as the image came into his mind, the sun rose brilliantly just over the bluff, and the thought faded as quickly as it had come, leaving him with a slightly dazed feeling and a tingling that climbed rapidly up his spine. He put on his cap. Jackie led the way through the thicket, walking as rapidly as the low branches would allow, bending almost double in places. Ray followed him, and the women came after. Shortly, they emerged from the trees onto a rocky area that ran along the foot of the bluff like a narrow path. When he reached it, Jackie stopped and waited while the others caught up. "Do you still think this is the old homestead?" he quipped. The women laughed sharply, then fell into animated conversation in the old language. Neither Ray nor Jackie could talk it, so they stood waiting, admiring the beauty of the morning, feeling the cold dawn air on their cheeks, and the water still making their jeans cling to their ankles. At least their feet were dry, and so were the tennies they'd replaced after leaving the river. After a few animated exchanges, the women started up the path, the men following. "She says it's this way," Linda said over her shoulder. "It can't be far." They trudged along for what seemed a long time, following the line of the bluff that seemed to grow even higher. After a time, Junella turned into a narrow break in the rock and began to trudge up its gradual slope, which soon became a steep rise. "I bet we're not going to Grandma's house," Jackie said in a quiet tone to his friend. "I didn't know this bluff was even here," Ray replied. "It's not much farther," Junella said cheerfully. "What's the matter? You dudes out of shape or something?" "Well, I used to say I'd walk a mile for a camel," Jackie said wryly, "but I didn't say anything about snags." He and Ray laughed, perhaps more heartily than the joke warranted. "This is the only time I've heard of Little Red Riding Hood leading the wolves to Grandma's," Ray muttered.
"Yeah," Linda responded brightly, "and wait till you see what I'm carrying in my basket of goodies."
Both women laughed, the men abashedly joining in. "Here's the little creek I was looking for," Junella said suddenly. "Let's walk in it for a while." Ray looked at Jackie quizzically.
"I don't want to walk in that," Jackie said quickly. "I just got dry from the last dip."
The women were already in the water, walking upstream.
"Not to worry," Junella said. "It's not wet. It's the path to the old house."
"Yeah, right," Ray mumbled, stepping into the water with a sigh.
Jackie followed him, falling silent. But as they stepped into what they thought was a fast-moving stream of water, their feet touched down on soft grass.
"Hey," Ray exclaimed, "what's happening?"
He stopped abruptly, and Jackie plowed into him.
"Watch it, man," the smaller man said.
He brushed past Ray and made after the women who were disappearing around a sharp turn. Ray stood rooted a moment, then hurried after him.
"Wait up," he called.
his voice echoed loudly against the cliff. As Ray turned the corner, he saw Linda reaching upward along the cliff where a tall rock slab leaned against it. She grasped the edge of the slab and pulled. To the men's astonishment, it swung open, for all the world like an ordinary door. The women stepped through. Ray and Jackie regarded each other for long moments. Finally, Ray shrugged and Jackie gestured with his outspread arm at the opening in the cliff. They followed the women inside. Within, they were greeted with an astonishing scene. Scores of people, perhaps upward of 200, stood or walked about a green land. Houses stood scattered in the near distance, and smoke arose from a few chimneys. There were tables spread under some large trees, sycamore or elm, Ray thought, and upon them, food in large quantities and tantalizing variety beckoned to the men. Suddenly aware that they hadn't eaten since early the day before, they started forward. But before they'd taken more than a few steps, Linda and Junella took their arms and led them away from the feast toward the doorway of one of the houses. There sat a man who seemed ancient to the young men. His age wasn't so much in his hair, though it hung in waist-long white strands. It wasn't even so much in his skin, wrinkled and weathered though it was beneath the tall crowned hat he wore. It was just that he seemed to be age personified. He seemed to be older than the bluff, then the river, then even the sky. Next to him, two large mastiffs, their long, lean bodies relaxed, their heads raised, their eyes alert and full of intelligence. "So," the old one said to the women, "I see you've snagged two young men." He shot a half-amused glance at the young men's direction. "Go, get ready," he directed the women, and at his words they slipped into the house, closing the door softly behind themselves. The young men stood uneasily beside the old man who, disregarding them completely, seemed lost in his own thoughts as he gazed steadily at some point directly before them. After maybe half an hour had passed, the old man addressed the young men again. "It's a good thing you did," he mused, "following my nieces here. I wonder that you didn't give up or get lost along the way." He chuckled quietly, as at a private joke. "Maybe you two are intelligent men." He turned his head suddenly and gave them an appraising look. Each of the young men shifted under that knowing gaze uncomfortably. From somewhere, the ground, the sky, they didn't feel sure. They heard thunder rumbling. "I have told everybody that they did well for themselves by bringing you here." Seeing the surprised look on their faces, he smiled. "Yes, you didn't hear me. I know. I guess we talk different here than you're used to where you come from. Maybe you'll be here long enough to get used to it," he added. "That is, if you like my nieces well enough." "We'll feed you soon," he said. "But first, there are some games I want you to join in." He pointed with pursed lips in the direction of a low hill that rose just beyond the farthest dwelling. Again the thunder rumbled, louder than before. A moment later the women appeared. Their long flowing hair was gone, and their heads shone in the soft light that filled the area, allowing distant features to recede into its haze. The women wore soft clothing that completely covered their bodies, even their hands and feet. It seemed to be of a bright, gleaming cloth that reflected the light at the same intensity as their bald heads. Their dark eyes seemed huge and luminous against skin that somehow gave off a soft radiance. Seeing them, both men were nearly overcome with fear. "They have no hair at all," Ray thought. "What is this place?" He glanced over at Jackie, whose face mirrored his own unease. Jackie shook his head, almost imperceptibly, slowly moving it from side to side in a gesture that seemed mournful, and at the same time, oddly, resigned. Linda and Junella moved to the young men, each taking the hand of one and drawing him toward the central area nearby. In a daze, Ray and Jackie allowed themselves to be led into the center of the area ringed by heavily laden tables, barely aware that the old man had risen from his place and, with his dogs, was following behind them. They were joined by a number of other young men, all wearing caps like the one Ray and Jackie wore. Two of the men carried bats, several wore gloves, and one was tossing a baseball in the air as he walked. Slowly, the throng made their way past the tables and came to an open area where Jackie and Ray saw familiar shapes. They were bases, and the field that the soft light revealed to them was a baseball diamond. The old man took his place behind home plate, and one of the young men crouched before him as a loud peal of thunder crashed around them. "Play ball!" the old man shouted, and the men took up their places as the women retired to some benches at the edge of the field, behind home plate, where they sat. The bewildered young men found their positions and the game was on. It was a hard-played game, lasting some time. At length, it reached a rowdy end. The team Jackie and Ray were on barely edging out the opposition, in spite of a couple of questionable calls the old man made against them. Their victory was due in no small measure to a wiry young man's superb pitching. He'd pitched 2 no-hit innings, and that had won them the game. As they walked with the other players back toward the houses, the old man came up to them. Slapping each on the back a couple of times, he told them he thought that they were good players. "Maybe that means you'll be ready for tomorrow's games," he said, watching Jackie sharply. "They're not what you're used to, I imagine, but you'll do all right." They reached the tables and were helped to several large portions of food by people whose faces never seemed to come quite into focus, but whose goodwill seemed unquestionable. They ate amid much laughter and good-natured joshing, only belatedly realizing that neither Linda nor Junella was among the revelers. Ray made his way to Jackie and asked him if he'd seen either woman. Replying in the negative, Jackie offered to go look around for them. They agreed to make a quick search and rendezvous at the large tree near the old man's house. But after a fruitless hour or so, Ray went to the front of the house and waited for his friend, who didn't come. At last, growing bored, he made his way back to the tables where a group had set up a drum and were singing lustily. A few of the younger people had formed a tight circle around the drummers and were slowly stepping around in it, their arms about each other's waists and shoulders. "All right," Ray thought, cheered. 49s. He joined the circle between 2 women he hadn't seen before, who easily made way for him, and smoothly closed the circle with him again as each wrapped an arm around his waist. He forgot all about his friend. When Ray awoke, the sun was beating down on his head. He sat up and realized he was lying near the river's edge, his legs in the thicket, his head and half-turned face unshielded from the sun. It was about a third of the way up in a clear sky. As he looked groggily around, he discovered Junella sitting quietly a few yards away on a large stone. "Hey," she said, smiling. "How'd I get here?" Ray asked. He stood and stretched, surreptitiously feeling to see if everything worked. His memory seemed hesitant to return clearly, but he had half-formed impressions of a baseball game and eating and then the 49. He looked around. "Where's Jackie and, Linda?" Junella supplied as he paused. "Yeah, Linda. Jackie is staying there, she told him calmly. She reached into her bag and brought out a man's wristwatch. He said to give you this, she said, holding it out to him. Ray felt suddenly dizzy. He swayed for a moment while strange images swept through him. Junella with no hair and that eerie light. The one that was some pale tan but had spots or a pattern of soft gray dots that sort of fuzzed out at the edges to blend into the tan. The old man. He took a step in her direction. Hey, he began. What the hell's? But broke off. The rock where she sat was empty. On the ground next to it lay Jackie's watch. When Ray told me the story, about 15 months afterward, he'd heard that Jackie had showed up at his folks' place. They lived out in the country, a mile or so beyond one of the numerous small towns that dot the Oklahoma landscape. The woman who told him about Jackie's return, Jackie's cousin Ruth Ann, said he had come home with a strange woman who was a real fox. At 13, Ruth Ann had developed an eye for good looks and thought herself quite a judge of women's appearance. They hadn't stayed long, he'd heard. Mainly, they packed up some of Jackie's things and visited with his family. Ray had been in Tulsa and hadn't heard Jackie was back until then. None of their friends had seen him either. There had been a child with them, he said. Maybe 2 years old, Ruth Ann had thought, because she could walk by herself. You know, Ray had said thoughtfully, turning a Calistoga slowly between his big hands, a gesture that made him seem very young and somehow vulnerable. One of my grandfather's brothers, old Jess, used to talk about the little people a lot. He used to tell stories about strange things happening around the countryside here. I never paid much attention. You know how it is. I just thought he was putting me on, or maybe he was pining away for the good old days. He said that dear woman would come to dances sometimes, and if you weren't careful, she'd put her spell on you and take you inside the mountain to meet her uncle. He said her uncle was really Thunder, one of the old gods or supernaturals, whatever the traditionals call them. He finished his drink and a couple of swallows and pushed away from the table we were sitting at. I don't know, he said, and gave me a look that I still haven't forgotten. A look that was somehow wounded, and yet with a kind of wild hope mixed in. Maybe those old guys know something, huh? It was a few years before I saw him again. Then I ran into him unexpectedly in San Francisco a couple of years before. We talked for a while, standing on the street near the Mission BART station. He started to leave when my curiosity got the better of my manners. I asked if he'd ever found out what had happened to Jackie. Well, he said that he'd heard that Jackie came home off and on, but the woman, probably Linda, though he wasn't sure, was never with him. Then he'd heard that someone had run into Jackie, or a guy they thought was him, up in Seattle. He'd gone alcoholic. Later, they'd heard he died. But you know, Ray said, the weird thing is that he'd evidently been telling someone all about that time inside the mountain, and that he'd married her, and about some other stuff, I guess he wasn't supposed to tell. Another guy down on his luck, he guessed. Remember how I was telling you about my crazy uncle, the one who used to tell about dear woman? Until I heard about Jackie, I'd forgotten that the old man used to say that the ones who stayed there were never supposed to talk about it. If they did, they died in short order. After that, there didn't seem to be much more to say. Last time I saw Ray, he was heading down the steps to catch BART. He was on his way to a meeting, and he was running late. And that was Dear Woman by Paula Gunn Allen. This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. If you miss a program,
You can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.
Now we will read Swimming Upstream by Beth Brandt. Anna May spent the first night in a motel off Highway 8. She arrived around 10, exhausted from her long drive. The drive through farmland, bright autumn leaves, the glimpse of Blue Lake. She saw none of this, only the gray highway stretching out before her. When she saw the signs of a motel, she stopped, feeling the need for rest. It didn't matter where. She took a shower, lay in bed, and fell asleep, the dream beginning again. Her son, drowning in the water, his skinny arms flailing the waves, his mouth opening to scream, but no sound coming forth. She, Anna May, moving in slow motion, running into the waves, her hands grabbing for the boy, and feeling only water run through her fingers. She grabbed and grabbed, but nothing held to her hands. She dove and opened her eyes underwater and saw nothing. He was gone. She dove and grabbed, her hands connecting with sand, with seaweed, but not her son. He was gone. Simon was gone. Anna May woke. The dream was not a nightmare anymore. It had become a companion to her, a friend, almost a lover, reaching for her as she slept, making pictures of her son, keeping him alive while recording his death. In the first days after Simon left her, the dream made her wake up screaming, sobbing, arms hitting at the air, legs kicking the sheets, becoming tangled in the material. Her bed was a straitjacket, pinning her down, holding her until the dream ended. She would fight the dream then. Now she welcomed it. During the day, she had other memories of Simon, his birth, his first pair of shoes, his first steps, his first word, Mama, his first book, his first day of school. Now that he was dead, she invented a future for him during the day. His first skating lessons, his first hockey game, his first reading aloud from a book, his first. But she couldn't invent beyond that. His 6-year-old face and body wouldn't change in her mind. She couldn't invent what she couldn't imagine. The dream became the final video of her imaging. She hadn't been there when Simon drowned. Simon had been given to her ex-husband by the courts. She was unfit because she lived with a woman, because a woman, Catherine, slept beside her, because she had a history of alcoholism. The history was old. Anna May had stopped drinking when she became pregnant with Simon, and she had stayed dry all those years. She couldn't imagine what alcohol tasted like after Simon came. He was so lovely, so new. The desire for drink evaporated every time Simon took hold of her finger, or nursed from her breast, or opened his mouth in a toothless smile. She had marveled at his being, this gift that had come from her own body. This beautiful being who had formed inside her had come with speed through the birth canal to welcome life outside her, his face red with anticipation, his black hair sticking straight up as if electric with hope, his little fists grabbing, his pink mouth finding her nipple and holding on for dear life. She had no need for alcohol. There was Simon. Simon was taken away from them, but they saw him on weekends, Tony delivering him on a Friday night, Catherine discreetly finding someplace else to be when his car drove up. They still saw Simon, grateful for the 2 days out of the week they could play with him, they could delight in him,
they could pretend with him. They still saw Simon. But the call came that changed all that. The call from Tony saying that Simon had drowned when he fell out of the boat as they were fishing. Tony sobbing, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean for this to happen. I tried to save him. I'm sorry. Please, Anna, forgive me. Oh, God, Anna. I'm sorry. I'm sorry." So Anna May dreamed of those final moments of a 6-year-old life, and it stunned her that she wasn't there to see him die when she had been there to see him come into life. Anna May stayed dry, but she found herself looking into cupboards at times, looking for something to drink. She thought of ways to buy wine and hide it, taking a drink when she needed it. But there was Catherine. Catherine would know, and Catherine's face, already so lined and tired and old, would become more so. Anna May looked at her own face in the mirror. She was 36 and looked 20 years older. Her black hair had gray streaks she hadn't noticed before. Her forehead had deep lines carved into the flesh, and her eyes that had cried so many tears, were a faded and washed-out blue. Her mouth was wrinkled, the lips parched and chapped. She and Catherine were aged and ghost-like figures walking through a dead house. Anna May thought about the bottle of wine. It took on large proportions in her mind. A bottle of wine, just one, that she could drink from and never empty. A bottle of wine, that sweet red kind that would take away the dryness, the wrinkles inside of her. She went to AA meetings, but never spoke, only saying her name and, "I'll pass tonight." Catherine wanted to talk, but Anna May had nothing to say to this woman she loved, who slept beside her, who shared the same dream. Anna May thought about the bottle of wine. The bottle, the red liquid inside, the sweet taste gathering in her mouth, moving down her throat, hitting her bloodstream, warming her inside, killing the deadness. She arranged time off work and told Catherine she was going away for a few days. She needed to think, to be alone. Catherine watched her face, the framing of the words out of her mouth, her washed-out eyes. Catherine said, "I understand." "Will you be all right?" Anna May asked of her. "I'll be fine," Catherine said. "I'll see friends. We haven't seen our friends in so long. They're concerned about us. I'll be waiting when you get back. I love you so much." Anna May got in the car and drove up 401, up 19, over to 8 and the motel, the shower, the dream. Anna May smoked her cigarettes and drank coffee until daylight. She made her plans to buy the bottle of wine. After that, she had no other plans, other than that first drink and how it would taste and feel. She found an AA meeting in Goderich and sat there, ashamed and angered with herself, to sit in a meeting and listen to the stories and plan her backslide. She thought of speaking, of talking about Simon, about the bottle of wine, but she was afraid they would stop her or say something that would make her stop. Anna May didn't want to be stopped. She wanted to drink and drink and drink until it was all over. "My name is Anna May, and I'll just pass." Later, she hung around for coffee, feeling like an infiltrator, a spy, and a woman took hold of her arm and said, "Let's go out and talk. I know what you're planning. Don't do it. Let's talk." Anna May shrugged off the woman's hand and left. She drove to a liquor outlet, Vins et Spiritu. "Don't do it." She found the wine, one bottle. That was all she'd buy. "Don't do it." One bottle. That was all.
She paid and left the store. The familiar curve of the bottle wrapped in brown paper. Don't do it. Only one bottle. It wouldn't hurt. And she laughed at the excuses bubbling up in her mouth like wine. Just one.
She smoked a cigarette sitting in the parking lot, wondering where to go, where to stop and turn the cap that would release the red, sweet smell of the wine before the taste would overpower her and she wouldn't have to wonder anymore. She drove north on 21, heading for the Bruce Peninsula, Lake Huron on her left, passing the little resort towns, the cottages by the lake. She stopped for a hamburger, and without thinking, got her thermos filled with coffee. This made her laugh, the bottle sitting next to her, almost a living thing. She drank the coffee, driving north along 21, thinking not of Simon, not of Catherine, but thinking of her father. Charles, her mother had called him. Everyone else had called him Charlie. Good old Charlie. Good time Charlie. Engine Charlie. Charles was a hard worker, working at almost anything, construction being his best and favorite. He worked hard, but he drank hard. He attempted to be a father, a husband, but the work and the drink took his attempts away. Anna Mae's mother never complained, never left him. She cooked and kept house, raised the children, and always called him Charles. When Anna Mae grew up, she taunted her mother with the fact that her Charles was a drunk, and why didn't she care more about her kids than her drunken husband? Didn't her mother know how ashamed they were to have such a father? To hear people talk about him, to laugh at him, to laugh at them, the half-breeds of good old good-time Injun Charlie? Anna Mae laughed again, the sound ugly inside the car. Her father was long dead and, she supposed, forgiven in some way by her. He was a handsome man back then, and her mother a skinny, pale girl, an orphan girl, something unheard of by her father. How that must have appealed to the romantic that was her father. Anna Mae didn't know how her mother felt about the life she'd had with Charles. Her mother never talked about those things. Her mother, who sobbed and moaned at Simon's death, as she never had at her husband's. Anna Mae couldn't remember her father ever being mean. He just went away when he drank. Not like his daughter, who'd fight anything in her way when she was drunk. The bottle bounced beside her as she drove. Anna Mae drove north, and her eyes began to see the colors of the trees. They looked like they were on fire, the reds and oranges competing with the yellows and golds. She smoked her cigarettes and drank from the thermos and remembered this was her favorite season. She and Catherine would be cleaning the garden, harvesting the beets, turnips, and cabbage. They would be digging up the gladioli and letting them dry before packing the bulbs away. They would be planting more tulips, because Catherine could never get enough of tulips. It was because they had met in the spring, Catherine always said. We met in the spring, and the tulips were blooming in that little park. You looked so beautiful against the tulips, Simon on your lap. I knew I loved you. Last autumn, Simon had been 5, and had raked leaves and dug holes for the tulip bulbs. Catherine had made cocoa and cinnamon toast, and Simon had declared that he liked cinnamon toast better than pie. Anna Mae tasted the salt tears on her lips. She licked the wet salt, imagining it was sweet wine on her tongue. It's my fault, she said out loud. She thought of all the things she should have done to prevent Simon's leaving. She should have placated Tony. She should have lived alone. She should have pretended to be straight. She should never have become an alcoholic. She should never have loved. She should never have been born. Let go, she cried somewhere inside her. Let go.
Isn't that what she learned? But how could she let go of Simon and the hate she had for Tony and for herself? How could she let go of that? If she let go, she'd have to forgive. The forgiveness Tony begged of her now that Simon was gone. Even Catherine, even the woman she loved, asked her to forgive Tony. It could have happened when he was with us, Catherine cried at her. Forgive him, then you can forgive yourself. But Catherine didn't know what it was to feel a baby inside her, to feel him pushing his way out of her, to feel his mouth on her breast, to feel the sharp pain in her womb every time his name was mentioned. Forgiveness was for people who could afford it. Anna May was poverty-struck. The highway turned into a road, the trees crowding in on both sides of her, the flames of the trees almost blinding her. She was entering the Bruce Peninsula, a sign informed her. She pulled off the road, consulting her map. Yes, she would drive to the very tip of the peninsula, and it would be there she'd open the bottle and drink her way to whatever she imagined was there. The bottle rested beside her. She touched the brown paper, feeling soothed, feeling a hunger in her stomach. She saw another sign, Salbo Falls. Anna May thought this would be a good place to stop, to drink the last of the coffee, to smoke another cigarette. She pulled over onto the gravel lot. There was a small path leading down onto the rocks. Another sign. Absolutely no fishing. Watch your steps. Rocks are slippery. She could hear the water before she saw it. She stepped out of the covering of trees and onto the rock shelf. The falls were narrow, spilling out on various layers of rock. She could see the beginnings of Lake Huron before her. She could see movement in the water going away from the lake and moving toward the rocks and the falls. Fish tails flashed, catching lights from the sun. Hundreds of fish tails moving upstream. She walked across a flat slab of rock and there, beneath her in the shallow water, salmon slowly moving their bodies, their gills expanding and closing as they rested. She looked up to another rock slab, and saw a dozen fish congregating at the bottom of a water spill, waiting. Her mind barely grasped the fact that the fish were migrating, swimming upstream, when a salmon leapt and hurled itself over the rushing water above it. Anna May stepped up to another ledge and watched the salmon's compatriots waiting their turn to jump the flowing water and reach the next plateau. She looked down toward the mouth of the lake. There were other people, like her, standing and silently watching the struggle of the fish. No one spoke, as if to speak would be blasphemous in the presence of this. She looked again into the water, the fish crowding each resting place before resuming the leaps and the jumps. Here and there on the rocks, dead fish. A testimony to the long and desperate struggle that had taken place. They lay, eyes glazed, sides open and bleeding, food for the gulls that hovered over Anna May's head. Another salmon jumped, its flesh torn and gaping, its body spinning and hurtling until it made it over the fall. Another one, its dorsal fin torn, leapt and was washed back by the power of the water. Anna May watched the fish rest, its open mouth like another wound. The fish was large, the dark body undulating in the water. She watched it begin a movement of the tail. Churning the water, it shot into the air, twisting its body, shaking and spinning. She saw the underbelly, pale yellow and bleeding from the battering against the rocks, the water. He made it. Anna May wanted to clap, to shout with elation at the sheer power of such a thing happening before her. She looked around again. The other people had left. She was alone with the fish.
The only sound besides the water was her breath against the air. She walked farther upstream, her sneakers getting wet from the splashing of the fish. She didn't feel the wet. She only waited and watched for the salmon to move. She had no idea of time, of how long she stood waiting for the movement, waiting for the jumps, the leaps, the flight. Anna May watched for Torn Fin, wanting to see him move against the current in his phenomenal swim of faith. Anna May reached a small dam, the last hurdle before the calm waters and the blessed rest. She sat on a rock, her heart beating fast, the adrenaline pouring through her at each leap and twist of the fish. There he was, Torn Fin, his last jump ahead of him. She watched, then closed her eyes, almost ashamed to be a spectator at this act of faith, this primal movement to get to the place of all beginning, only knowing he had to get there. He had to push his bleeding body forward, believing in his magic to get him there. Believing he would get there. No thoughts of death, no thoughts of food, no thoughts of rest, no thoughts, but the great urging and wanting to get there. Get there. Anna May opened her eyes and saw him, another jump before being pushed back. She held her hands together, her body willing Torn Fin to move, to push, to jump, to fly. Her body rocked forward and back, her heart beating madly inside her breast. She rocked. She shouted, "Make it, damn it! Make it!" The fish gathered at the dam. She rocked and held her hands tight, her fingers twisting together, nails scratching her palms. She whispered, "Simon, Simon." She rocked. She rocked and watched Torn Fin's fight to reach his home. She rocked and whispered the name of her son into the water. "Simon, Simon," like a chant. "Simon, Simon, Simon," into the water, as if the very name of her son was magic and could move the salmon to their final place. She rocked. She chanted, "Simon, Simon." Anna May rocked and put her hands in the water, wanting to lift the fish over the dam into life. Just as the thought flickered through her brain, Torn Fin slapped his tail against the water and jumped. He battled the current. He twisted and arced into the air, his great mouth gaping and gasping, his wounds standing out in relief against his body, the fin discolored and shredded. With a push, he turned a complete circle and made it over the dam. "Simon!" Torn Fin gave one more slap of his tail and was done, the dark body swimming home. She thought she saw her son's face, his black hair streaming behind him, a look of joy transfixed on his little face before the image disappeared. Anna May stood on the rock, her hands limp at her sides, watching the water, watching the salmon, watching. She watched as the sun fell behind the lake and night came closer to her. She walked to the path and back to her car. She looked at the bottle sitting next to her, the brown paper rustling as she put the car in gear. She drove south, stopping at a telephone booth. She could still hear the water in her ears. And that was Swimming Upstream by Beth Bryant. Thank you for joining us again for Western Short Stories, as we've been reading Talking Leaves, Contemporary Native American Short Stories, edited by Craig Leslie. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts.
You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.